pen, I write with a goose quill dipped in venom. Hello and welcome to episode 185 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other laconic detectives as masterpieces. I am Nick, I am the missing girl of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
Probably a two-faced hero.
I would have thought so. We are back in our happy place, which is basically 1940s film noir. Any film noir generally, but particularly 30s and 40s. But this is our first outing for Otto Preminger, as we discuss his potential masterpiece, 1944's Laura. Or Laura. Laura. It's Laura, isn't it?
Laura. Yeah, the name comes from the play. That van has its own complicated history. Where should we start with this?
Let's start with the origins of it then. What's the origins of the play and the writing?
Well, okay. So I don't want to start there. I want to start with Preminger himself, because he emigrated to the USA in the mid 1930s. Not for the
but he was
reason.
German, wasn't he?
Yes, he was headhunted by Joseph Schenck, who was one of the studio.
He had actually done a German language film, I think, in Germany in the early 30s.
Yeah, I think he was already reasonably well known in Germany, and it was one of those. Yeah, maybe I think about moving because things are going in an obvious.
And this
direction.
Is Hollywood at the height of the studios, and also the height of the motion picture code or the Hays code.
But I think it's important to remember that he is primarily a theatrical director, and because this is going to matter when we come back. So basically, Joseph Schenck, Darryl F. Zanuck, 20th Century Fox co-founders, headhunted him. They did not get on particularly after that. But basically, he wasn't the instant money machine that they thought they were getting, but. So he did continue to work in theatre.
After being headhunted.
This is the key thing. I'm just making films as well, obviously. So he came across Vera Kasperi's short story and play. Specifically, it was the play that he met first, called Ring Twice for Laura. And he liked the setting and the plot twist. It was not wildly different.
We should point out, as with ever with Ribbon of Memes, there are heavy spoilers, but particularly for this film, which is a plot twist film.
Yeah. He felt the work needed a major revision, and he basically went to Kasperi and said, let me rewrite it with you. And she, oddly enough, said no. She eventually collaborated with George Sklar to rewrite that. While Linda Dietrich was interested in playing Laura, but they couldn't get the without a producer willing to finance it, they couldn't make it work. She eventually adapted the play into a novel, also called Ring Twice for Laura, and a sequel, just called
Which is
Laura,
odd because Laura is the
which
murder
20th Century Fox. Yes, which 20th Century Fox then bought, optioned. And basically, Preminger then presumably raised his head and say, "Hey, I vaguely know about this," and that put him on redeveloping them. He was not going to be.
No, in fact, the film started with a different director,
and he started off with essentially not telling Kasperi even that he was working on this until he had his first draft done. And the main thing he changed is to shift the character of interest and the character of focus from Laura, because here, who cares about a woman's story, to Lydecker. We will come back to Lydecker.
Lydecker, who is the writer who we introduced to at the beginning of the film, Waldo. Yes.
Yeah. So Kasperi was unhappy, but hey, usual contract, she doesn't get to say.
Well, a writer in Hollywood, I mean, what are they?
For it. Yeah. That was that. And the point about this is that, yeah, he had met the story before he actually started working on it. But this was very much a studio thing, and they originally announced, I think it was George Saunders and Laird Tregear as the leads, and that just didn't help, didn't work. Nobody wanted to direct it, possibly because everybody knew that Preminger felt strongly and proprietorially about it. Eventually, Ruben Mamoulian agreed to kick in. Now, he is... he's 10, 12, 15 films in by this point, and he is a
so
studio.
So on the kind of one after the other, studio.
One every year or two, typically. I don't think we've ridden of memes any of his films, but honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if we had. He did Queen Christina. He did Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 31. He did The Mark of Zorro in 40, and so on. So he was on this, and so here's an interesting thing. He had actually directed Gene Tierney before in Rings on His
Gene
Fingers.
Gene Tierney,
2 years
who will play Laura in the film.
Yeah. This is one of the things that Preminger got in. He wanted relative unknowns. And Tierney, I think, started in about 40, 41.
I mean, I have to say that, was it because of this film? But a lot of them weren't unknowns for very long after Laura.
This was definitely the star-making thing for her, and indeed for Preminger.
And Dana Andrews, I think.
Though he did a lot of westerns later, but you know, it was the 40s and 50s, there were a lot of westerns being made. One can't hold that against him. It got complicated, and it was not a happy set. Mamoulian wanted to cast Laird Tregear, who was the original.
So he was he'd known for Jack the Ripper and kind of murderous roles.
That was the problem. Yeah, he had just been in The Lodger.
Was that Hitchcock's
also.
The Lodger, presumably?
This is
John
Hitchcock's,
or maybe Hitchcock remade his. Anyway, he was a known Vadden on the screen.
The point is, audiences at the time would have thought this man is a villain, and you know, we'll come back to the nature of the role. But Preminger definitely did not want the audience to be feeling suspicious about him early in the film. So they shifted to Clifton Webb, who was he'd not been on screen for a while. He was basically working on Broadway. At the time, he was appearing in Blythe Spirit in Los Angeles, so he was available. Then the casting director, Anne Zanuck, said, well, I mean, probably censoring what they said he had...
I wonder what that meant in the 40s. as he does...
And Preminger said, that's what I want.
I mean, he's an immediate... As far as casting, it's a great casting decision because... He's immediately brilliant. He's got that very kind of Noel Coward, kind of detached kind of, I mean, he is, he's clearly gay, but it's, well, there's no but about it, but there is like,
no, I think
confirmed
he's a
bachelor,
bachelor,
but he's got that very kind of, what am I trying to say? That waspish, to him that is like, very, cynical, which immediately endears him to me in a very rapid order.
So filming starts, and it's not a happy set. And as I say, he's worked with Gene Tierney before, but he basically lets them get on with it. Doesn't really give them much in the way of. What
now, is this Mamoulian?
This is Mamoulian directing. Yeah, Judith Anderson, who is a. What would you call her? A secondary female character. She's
is she Sybil?
Yeah, not definitely. One
oh, Anne. Oh, yeah.
But she, Anderson is theatrically trained, and she is basically playing to the balcony and overdoing it. He's ignoring Webb, the replacement for Lydecker, because he doesn't like.
Yeah,
him
so Clifton's found he's got to the set and he's found out he isn't really wanted there, so that doesn't help for a happy set.
Yeah, so there is a meeting with Mamoulian and Preminger, who is, after all, still the producer, and Zanuck from the studio. Everybody blames everybody else, but eventually they say, all right, Preminger, you can direct it. And Preminger goes in, he was expecting the cast to be, because yeah, Mamoulian has said, Preminger doesn't like what you're doing, do it better. But when he comes in, he finds that actually they're quite prepared to work with him.
One of the first things he does is get rid of the photo of Zanuck's wife. There's a portrait of Laura, which is basically a portrait of Zanuck's wife, I think, the producer Zanuck. And he gets rid of that and replaces it with a touched up photo to make it look like a portrait.
I think it was still Tierney. No, the original picture. I haven't seen the original picture, but as I understand it, it was Mamoulian's.
Oh, I see. Okay, I've got that mixed up then.
Of Tierney, but Preminger started with a photograph and then got it lightly retouched
to look like an oil paint
to give the sort of ethereal effect. But yeah, basically, once that got started, it went slightly over budget, but it was basically a fairly happy filming.
It's unusual for Preminger because he was one of those directors that pretty much came in on budget most times.
Zanuck insisted on a new ending, in which
the Dallas ending, we'll call it.
It was all imagined by. Yeah, we'll come back to that. But basically, they this is one of those arrangements of they arranged for a prominent film columnist to watch the Zanuck version and then approach Zanuck and say, I didn't get the ending, you've got to change it.
And at that point, I think Zanuck pretty much ceded control of the film to Preminger to do what he liked.
Yeah. So, yeah, it has a troubled genesis, but I think it's significant to know that to get a red appreciation of the actual story. And the actual story is the dame is dead.
Laura is dead at the start.
And that's one of the things I like about this. We are coming in the middle of the story. It's not just the dame is dead, but, you know, the murder investigation has started.
Yes, we haven't even found the body. We start with Otto being awakened, well, not awakened, being rudely got out of his bath by the cynical... Not Otto, that's the director. Waldo is what I'm going to call him because I keep forgetting Light again. But we have immediately the hard-boiled, hard-bitten, cynical cop, Dana Andrews, who does a lovely job of being a hard-bitten film noir cynical guy. He's just utterly cool, disinterested. He's constantly playing with his little hand toy. I liked all these characters, their archetypes, film noir archetypes now, whether they were then, I don't know, but they're just great. So we have the kind of the waspish, cynical, bitter, is he a restaurant critic? What is he?
Columnist.
Yes, yeah. This was back in the days when columnists had huge sway, a la, The Sweet Smell of Success. When we were in the sort of the dying days of the columnists. But here, this is when it really meant something to have a column in a major newspaper. So we have this kind of, detached, cynical columnist and this world weary, hard boiled detective.
So he was known to be a friend of Laura. He denies that there was anything more to it because obviously he does.
Yes. And so the cop is interviewing basically everyone. Laura's been found dead in her apartment. Everyone knows it, I think, at this point. They're not shocked. I don't think he's given... Oh, well...
Yeah, yes. It's a few days later.
And then they go round to Laura's apartment. Some reason... So Waldo decides he wants to go along and watch the investigation, which is slightly...
I noted down at the time this detective is gradually... a trail of suspects following him from scene to scene.
I mean, you could argue Dana Andrews plays it well. So it's Mark, isn't it, the detective, McPherson. You could argue maybe he thinks, okay, well, maybe I'll learn something if he comes along with me as well. So you could argue it from a murder investigation point of view. I love that he's got a little notebook that he takes notes in. It's just everything about this. it's, again, the cinematography is lovely, kind of noir style. So they go to, I think it's Laura's apartment.
No, because, well, that's later, I think.
Well, they go to meet two more suspects, basically.
That's
right.
And this is Judith Anderson playing Anne Treadwell. But also there is Shelby Carpenter, who is is it fair to call him
a certainly a parasite, isn't it? A social climber, you might say. But he's clearly with Laura's aunt, not for entirely romantic reasons.
Well, she
well,
thinks
I, you know, I get the impression. Again, this is a noir film. I think she knows exactly the kind of person he is, but she's all right with that because she gets what she wants. It's a very sort of transactional relationship. That's the impression I got.
And she's getting the attention from the young man. And he of course is played by a 20th Century Fox contract player. So some guy named
Never heard of him.
Price, and it's really interesting to me to see him because he really isn't, he hasn't developed the Vincent Price look yet, except when his character gets angry and suddenly you can hear that guy coming through.
I did recognise him, but it took me probably a minute before I realised who it was. He hasn't got that kind of purr, and he hasn't got the kind of, it would be hard to look at him then and think what he would turn into as this horror icon. And that voice, as you say, it's not quite there, but it's great to, not that there's anything wrong with his performance at all. He's great, I think, as this slimy, I don't know. I was about to say Magaresque character of just kind of, obsequious and, but clearly with a hidden agenda and with no kind of heart in it. But he's very good as kind of a, this is what you want in this kind of film, is he's a suspect. Straight away, obviously. So he has been obviously there is something between him and Laura, as well as obviously there's something between Waldo and Laura, and the detective trying to get to untangle of what was happening where.
Shelby was engaged to marry Laura, though it turns out in the course of events that they had in fact broken that off, but that's what everybody's
well, and again, it turns out in the course of the investigation that Waldo Lydecker was unhappy with this arrangement, and so he wrote some columns about this.
Yeah, basically, we get the impression that there was this whole series of chaps who found Laura fascinating and Waldo sold them off.
Yeah, he's very kind of,
from a completely disinterested perspective, obviously. I mean, no
well, it's a funny relationship. It's a very kind of paternalistic, controlling relationship. Whether he's any interest in a physical relationship, it's hard to say. But so this is what we're trying to untangle, and we see the detective. We see some flashbacks of how Laura first met Waldo. So she's a young advertising executive. Would you call it? Trying to get Waldo to promote her company's product, and he just dismisses her out of hand because he's that kind of character, and very waspishly as well. But something about her brings up, and it's interesting, you know. So because she's dead, there's this fascination with, you know, the way she's described to McPherson. You can see why he starts to become sort of fascinated with this dead girl, because everyone is just like, oh my God, when we met her, she was just, they talk about her as this kind of angel of something more to her. And so he starts to become perhaps more than professionally interested with this dame than he should. So he does a bit more investigating, where he learns more about the slightly tangled web of relationships and how Waldo was not happy with Shelby, and how and sort of influenced Laura to break it off. How Shelby was having while he was with Laura, while he was engaged to Laura, he was also having an affair with one of the models in Laura's agency, I think. Diane, yes, Diane. Which may become relevant later. But I think the point, it's all lovely noir stuff, but what's happening over time is that this cynical detective is starting to become a bit like Vertigo, I feel, starting to become a bit obsessed with this idea of this girl. Embolized, that's absolutely the wrong word. He doesn't have an embolism. Symbolized by this painting that dominates her room. Mm. So we get to the point where he spends a night in there under the, kind of under the guise of investigating the crime, but actually sort of slightly creepily going through her drawers and sitting in a chair and thinking about her.
I mean, I think there are certainly fictional detectives who would try to soak in the feeling of the way somebody lived, and that maybe that's what's trying to be referred to here. I agree.
I feel like he's trying to tell himself that's what he's doing. But again, maybe I'm being too kind to it. But I feel like he's thinking, oh yeah, it's perfectly normal what I'm doing. I'm just getting close to the case. But actually, what he's doing is getting more and more obsessed with the idea of this woman.
But shock! Somebody comes into the apartment with a key.
Laura wasn't it's dead Laura. After all. She's not a murder victim.
And she doesn't even know that all this fuss has happened.
Well, she hadn't checked the internet for a while, so she's been off the grid. yeah, she went off up north somewhere. Can't remember. She's gone off to be alone for a bit, and it turns out the dead girl, who identified her then? I'm not sure how the body was positively identified.
She finds a dress in the closet and says, this is not my dress. I recognise this as belonging
to Diane,
whom she knows, obviously, because they're working at the same agency. Mark works out that, aha, nobody's seen Diane recently. That could be because she's in the morgue without a head.
Due to having a shotgun hit into it.
I think rather than going through the whole process of discovery, I think, is it fair to, if we say to...
Yes,
what
yeah,
happened?
I think at this...
So Shelby was using Laura's apartment for a liaison with Diane in his classy way. Somebody rang the bell. There was a kaboom, and Shelby panicked.
So he runs off to get a Anyway, there's a series of events where it seems as if Waldo's the prime suspect because he's running up. Sorry, not Waldo. Shelby. He runs to a cabin in the woods to get a shotgun, but he says he's just trying to protect Laura when he finds Laura still alive.
There's also the question of, was this shotgun the murder weapon? Which, actually, you can't do
this was my,
tests on shots.
This is my question here. I thought you couldn't with a shotgun. But...
Possibly you could say this is a different sort of shot shell or something of that sort, but it's fairly gross all this stuff.
Anyway, ballistics come back, and it turns out it wasn't that shotgun. It was a shotgun, but it wasn't that one that killed her, which we'll have to go with for the purpose of the film.
And it's all very confused. There's a party to celebrate Laura's return. McPherson arrests her for murdering Diane because obvious motive. He eventually becomes convinced that she's innocent. Also that she's not in love with Shelby, which, you know, is also important at this stage.
Again, he's doing it all by the book, but I like that you could read it another way, that one, he just wants to get her away from there and possess her in some sort of way and interrogate her in a way that isn't entirely relevant to what the murder investigation is. I like that. I detected sort of a change in his attitude in the, you get the impression that he's falling in love with his idea of Laura, and when she actually arrives as a person, she's a... And I'm definitely probably over-reading this, but I feel like, much as she is a bit to the audience, you know, that she's a slight disappointment, she's not quite what she lived up to be, I feel like she's a slight disappointment to him as well, and I detect he's a bit harder to her and a bit meaner. Maybe. Possibly, maybe I'm over-reading it.
And You can certainly, I think, look at this as parasociality. Yes. I mean, I'm remembering that there was a live-action role-playing group that I listened to about 10 years of their recordings over a space of about 2 years, and then met them because they ran a convention. And all of a sudden, you know, I know all the tricks of speech and in jokes and things, and they have no idea who I am. And this is
it's an awkward situation. So, during the course of the interview, he becomes convinced she wasn't the murderer, if he ever was.
And Shelby appears to be also.
So, who was the murderer?
And at this point, it's settling down in that. All right, I will admit that I love this film. I've only seen it this one time, but I'm certainly going to watch it again. But this is the point to me where it starts to settle down into, all right, we've had the exciting revelations. It's now pretty obvious what must have been going on, and we have a whole procedural bit to get through to get to the actual.
Yeah, we've got to wrap this plot up now. Yeah, that's fair.
And, you know, he searches Walder's apartment. There's a clock, just like the one in Laura's apartment, and it has a secret compartment in it, which is empty. And then he goes back to Laura's apartment, and then there's
a little sawn-off shotgun in there.
Well, I was going to say that the two men preening at each other and waving their peacock tails in front of Laura, and Waller obviously does the standard thing he does, which is try to put off any potential of Laura's interests. She sends him away. He pauses on the stairwell outside. Mark looks in this clock and finds, aha, here is the actual shotgun. He locks her in her apartment and tells her not to let anyone in. Because obviously that's the thing the police do. Waldo slips back in, gets the shotgun, and tries to kill Laura. And Mark is not unloaded.
Yeah, I feel like... Again... Yeah, I agree. This just feels a bit trite and simple, and involves a dropping of Mark's IQ by some points at this situation.
But Laura manages to avoid getting shot and gets away, and then Mark comes in, and then I think it's the sergeant who actually shoots Waldo down as he's trying to escape.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, and Mugface is too cool for that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and it sort of ends happily. So it turns out Waldo, who was weirdly jealous of Laura, was going to kill her.
Because if I can't...
And thought he had. In fact, everyone... Doesn't Shelby realise that she's not dead?
Yeah, because Shelby was there when Diane...
But he doesn't say anything. I mean, I love that he's... Yes, exactly. He's terrified. Not a murderer, but he is also a terrible person and a coward. And so...
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the stereotypes of the film, he is shown as unmanly.
Yes,
by this.
Yeah. But I agree. It just then has to. It's a bit like Timothy Dalton in The Rocketeer suddenly reverting to his German accent when you know he's a spy. Now that we know Waldo's the murderer, he has to then suddenly be murdery, rather than the kind of subtlety he'd shown. I mean, I agree, shooting someone's head off with a shotgun is perhaps not the peak of subtlety. But he just seems to take a huge...
Well, you know, if you're technical, go crude.
He just seems to take a huge risk at the end of the film for the purposes of knocking the film out, really, basically wrapping the plot up. But it would never have ended well anyway. But this is a noir film. I mean, I can't imagine McPherson and Laura have a happy relationship. I feel like she can never live up to this angel that he imagined, and he'll never stop fiddling with his little toy, so it's never going to work.
And he's out chasing murderers all night. Yeah.
Sleeping in strange women's apartments, and saying he's getting closer to the case. I agree. The ending is either rushed or just... It just doesn't... I mean, it's better than the original ending. Well, not the original ending. There's a Nook ending, which was... and he woke up and it was all a dream.
Specifically the Lydecker.
Yes, Lydecker had imagined it. Yes.
It was all his dream.
But it's great. I mean, the characters are great. As you say, we talked about Vincent Price. Gene Tierney, you do feel a bit underwhelmed by Laura. And I don't know... I genuinely don't know if that's deliberate on the film's part, that you are supposed to be a bit disappointed by the actual Laura. I think maybe I'm overdoing that, and I think probably you're not. But I think because she's had such a build-up, when she arrives, she's not really... it's not really much more than a pretty face. Is that fair? Am I being mean there? But she doesn't have a lot to do once she's not dead anymore. She doesn't show a lot of initiative. Maybe I'm more used to...
Yeah, I think the time we see her being most interesting is in that flashback.
Yes, absolutely. There she's great.
And as far as everybody else is concerned, she's beautiful, she's rich, what more do you need?
I agree, but you see there the kind of some of the magic that Waldo becomes, that everyone becomes obsessed with. But when she actually arrives as a not-dead person, I feel like it doesn't work as well, which is why I headcanoned it, that maybe that was a deliberate move on the film, but maybe I'm being a bit...
Possibly, and certainly, I suspect you may be ascribing too much.
I probably am.
But the fact that the film can support that is, I think, is a
yes.
point in its favour.
Yeah, I think that. I think it was hinted at, and I've maybe taken it more than it needs to be. Also, I like, is it Judith Treadwell? So the aunt, you know, there's a scene where,
Judith Anderson.
Judith Anderson. I'll just conflate the two. But there's a scene where her and Shelby just sort of lay their cards on the table. Or is it her and McPherson? But I think it is her and Shelby, and she's basically saying, "Look, I know what he is. I know what I'm getting from it. I know he wants other things, but don't." Just don't take. She's talking to Laura. That's it, and she's basically saying, "Don't take him away." She's really. It's kind of you see sort of through her cracked heart into what matters to her and what really matters, and she knows she's been taken for a ride, but she's accepted it. I don't know. I'm just very predisposed to like this sort of film. I like all those sort of actors. I thought it was great. I loved it. I loved seeing a young Vincent Price. I had my sole experience of Dana Andrews before was from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He's mentioned in the science fiction ton at the beginning of Dana Andrews said, runes gave him the prunes. And that's all I ever knew about. So to actually see him in the flesh, I thought he was a great hard-boiled character. It was great. I agree. The ending was rushed. But I would certainly watch this film again. It's right up my alley.
I would like to call out, I think possibly because it's just so much better than I expect and possibly than the film deserves. Laura has a domestic help called Bessie.
Yes.
Who is played by an uncredited Dorothy Adams. And this is clearly one of those thankless roles of, you know, she's got to be scared and superstitious and, you know, is there a ghost haunting the apartment and all that kind of thing. But she is Dorothy Adams. She is actually a long-standing character actor. God, 40, 50, 60 films maybe. She was also an acting instructor for many years, big on TV in the 50s, so on. It's not an amazing part, but she makes it actually seem a plausible character rather than the stereotype, and my goodness, that's pleasant to see.
I agree, absolutely. She doesn't steal the scenes because she's not overacting.
She's
in
not
that
supposed
way.
To.
She's not trying to, but yeah, she really, yeah, I totally agree. That is a good shout out for Bessie. Dorothy Adams, I should say. I would certainly like to see more of Premier. This is my first Preminger film, I think. I would like to... One film I've always wanted to watch and never have is Anatomy of a Murder.
Yeah, that is one of the two that is credited as blowing holes with the production code because they mention things in there that were not mentioned.
Yes, basically the details of rape and sexual crime and things, and then being more quite explicit about what that meant.
Same year, and that's the same year as Some Like It Hot, 1959.
Yeah, so I'm going to propose that for one of our future films. But I'd certainly like to watch more of him. I have a feeling I might get on with him well. But certainly on the basis of this, again, on, given that, unlike some other films, I expected this to be pretty good because I like this kind of film, but it was pretty good. So that slightly goes against my expectation thing that if you're expecting a film to be really good, it has to work harder, which I guess it does, but here it hit my expectations. I loved it. Certainly watch it again. Exactly my sort of film. The sort of film that I wanted to do this podcast for.
Yeah, the only problem I have with it is that way the ending's arranged. I'm not totally sure it could have been done better, done differently, but it just feels like a bit of a change of pace right at the end.
Yes, I think that is absolutely fair. It could have been handled better at the end. If it's a Coen's brother film, it would have just stopped. so better off than that. Very good. Thank you, Otto. More, please.
Yeah, indeed. I'm just because he died in 86, you know.
Well, doesn't hold you back now in the era of AI. they've done a whole film with Val Kilmer now. You'll be pleased to hear. Yeah, we should have done this whole podcast with just you saying that I was dead and then I could have cropped up halfway through. Anyway, good job. Let's watch more like that. And as far as was it a masterpiece? For me, I don't know, maybe I'm too enthusiastic. I feel that I can read a lot into it. I'd maybe have to watch it a couple more times to be sure, but I feel like it probably is, but maybe I'm just being cautious there.
I have a fairly small repertoire of noir films that I reach for and say, this is like that.
Yes.
And in that fairly small repertoire, which is, let's face it, some pretty good ones, such as The Maltese Falcon, I would say, yes, dash it, it is.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. That, you're right, the only reason I'd be cautious is the competition it's up against rather than it itself, but I think you're right, it probably is. All right. Well, on that not bombshell, we shall leave it there and return in a few weeks.